moved. I wish I was that good. Let me thank all of you for being here tonight. Some of you are here to be nice to me, and I'm very grateful for that. And some of you are here to try and find out what could be interesting about a subject to which you've paid very little attention all your life. And that second group is here in the true spirit of the university seminars, which Boris was just talking about. The sense that what really matters intellectually might just lie off on the edges of our expertise or beyond them. And the seminars exist as a place to get people involved in that territory, over on the edges of their expertise and beyond. So thank you all for being here. I want to talk first about the about why one should think about literary plots right now. I think the reason, the best reason, is that for well over 2,000 years, people have been working on the problem of what makes a text work, and particularly what makes a plot work, and coming up with some marvelous answers to those questions, and that right now the field is changing, because plots have always been interactive, but a whole new area of interaction has emerged. People have always gotten involved with dramas, and every decade or two you read about an actor who plays a villain so well that he gets shot in some provincial theater. Now there are computer games where you pull a trigger and shoot the villain. And the entire idea of interaction with a created text is beginning to change. So it's nice to sort of bring one's mind to bear on something which is becoming obsolete. I don't really think plots are becoming obsolete, but many of the ways that I'm going to be talking about will seem wonderfully antique in a few years. In 1960, I went to a play which had a table in the middle of the stage. And on that table, there was a hat. And out of that hat, the actors plucked pieces of paper in turn, from which they read their parts. I've spent better evenings. Tonight, my subject matter is what was missing that evening. We might think of it in terms of the practical problem that all literature faces. I've invented a substitute for PowerPoint, which you have in your seats. On the back of that substitute is a picture many of you will recognize of a sculpture of the prophet Laocoon in Homer and Virgil, who was destroyed with his two sons by sea serpents. Gotthold Lessing, writing about that sculpture, felt that it was made probably about the time that Jesus was crucified, to give you a date for it, early in the first century AD. And it can be studied in terms of cruelty, but an interesting thing about it is that Laocoon's mouth isn't opened in a scream. And Lessing explains that by essentially saying, if it had been, he'd have been screaming by now for 2,000 years. And that can't be, aesthetically, that can't work. So, but that there is something about sculpture which in his day did not move and was locked in time. Whereas literature moves in time but has another limitation, which is that's the only place that it can move. A novel is often a line of type, one character wide and a million characters long. There are very few things in art or nature that are that flimsy in shape. And the job of an author is to make something that shape hit you like a ton of bricks. He needs cement. And from Aristotle on, some of the best critics have felt that the plot is the best cement. This is the way literature combats the limitations that Lessing found in all literature. So then we come to the question of where do we find the plot? Well, I'm going to ask you to think of two works of literature in the next 2 weeks. First, King Lear, which I strongly recommend that you read or see if you can, and Crime and Punishment, which I hope you at least review. I think very few of you will be going to Cliff's Notes or Monarch Notes. We academics are snobs. And in general, summaries of literature are an art form that has been very little explored. Not because they aren't prevalent. You go to a secondhand bookstore and it's flooded with Reader's Digest abridged novels. Throughout them, it's not because they aren't important. In in the through the Middle Ages, the entire West knew Homer only through abridgments for practical purposes, these plot summaries matter. We'll be talking later about some of the philosophical implications about plot summaries, the question of representation is interesting. But now, let me talk for a second about the first plot summary that I can recall encountering. It was Lamb's Tales from Shakespeare, which I read before a couple of times before my parents took me to a Shakespeare play in the 40s. I looked at the end of Measure for Measure the other day. At the end of it, the Duke says, "Dear Isabel, I have a motion much imports your good, whereto, if you'll a willing ear incline, what's mine is yours, and what's yours is mine." This is obviously a marriage proposal, and George Lyman Kittredge, who was probably the greatest Shakespeare scholar of his generation, said, "We may infer that Isabel gives up her purpose to become becoming a votary of St. Clair, but this is not stated, and the play leaves the audience guessing, as was doubtless Shakespeare's intent." I'd like to read you the Lamb's plot summary of those four lines of Shakespeare's. "The Duke offered himself again to the acceptance of Isabel, whose virtuous and noble conduct had won her prince's heart. Isabel, not having taken the veil, was free to marry, and the friendly offices, while hid under the disguise of a humble friar, which the noble Duke had done for her, made her with grateful joy accept the honor he offered her, and when she became Duchess of Vienna, the excellent example of the virtuous Isabel worked such a complete reformation among the young ladies of that city that from that time none ever fell into the transgression of Julia," who'd been a whore, the repentant wife of the reformed Claudio, who'd been equally disreputable, and the mercy-loving Duke long reigned with his beloved Isabel, the happiest of husbands and of princes." A plot summary has a lot to do with a good many plot summaries. First of all, it's longer than the thing it summarizes. Second, the ambiguities disappear. And third, the expectation of the readership is fulfilled. And that's what makes me disagree with the people who say the plot summary of a work of literature is the plot of the work of a literature. At least the plot summary isn't really the thing that I'm going to be talking about today. If I'm not, I have to ask how I will define the plot of a work of literature. And I think I'll go back to Aristotle, and say that the plot is the arrangement of the incidents in a work of literature. Now, like many definitions, that leaves me with two words to define. Arrangement and incident. Let's start with incident. 30 years ago or 40 years ago, the fashionable thing to say about an incident is that it doesn't exist. It's something, at least it doesn't exist in a literary text. It's something that we readers impose upon the text. Roland Barthes, who was one of the most fashionable writers at that time, describes an incident as never more than the result of the artifice of reading. Whoever reads the text amasses certain data under some generic title for actions, stroll, murder, rendezvous, and this title embodies the sequence. That's what he calls an incident. The sequence exists when and because it can be given a name. It unfolds as the process of naming takes place. So I first have to say whether there is such a thing as an incident. My evidence for the existence of an incident is that they move around and migrate. There are books that will say, like Georges Poletti's, that there are only 36 dramatic situations. Other writers range from 7 to way over 1,000. But the idea that an incident is a finite thing that will crop up in text after text after text after text is a very standard idea. So that maybe an incident in a given text is hard to find, but if it really can move around, I worry. There are people like Orna and Stith Thompson who have made for folkloric texts huge dictionaries and given you texts that will crop up in Iceland and Indonesia and Lord knows where else in folk tales, bringing all of this together. So that my argument here would simply be if plots could talk, they would say, I move, and therefore I exist. I migrate, and therefore I exist. It's not a sophisticated argument. It's a little like Dr. Johnson's kicking a stone to prove the existence of the universe. And it's with that those books, like Orna and Stith Thompson, have been compared by literary theoreticians to dictionaries, and therefore looked down upon. You know Samuel Johnson's definition of a lexicographer, the greatest lexicographer ever, in his own dictionary, said defined a lexicographer as a harmless drudge. This is the attitude of a generation of literary theorists who said, we are grammarians. We look at the real rules governing literature, not just listing things. I will assume that a plot exists, and the question is, what's it like? First thing to be said that people say about plots is that they can come in any size. That to give again one theoretician, the concept of plot is a summarizing concept, uniting the verbal material of a work, uniting the verbal material of a work. A whole work may have its plot, and at the same time, each part of the work possesses its own plot. Such a separation out from a work of parts, each unified by a particular unity of plot, is called the analysis of the work. Mm. That's a way of saying that plots are fractal. half of you have worked with fractals. I have a picture on your handout on the left under Laocoon. A simple fractal curve is a straight line with a kink on it, and then a straight line with a kink on each kink, and then with a kink on each kink on each kink, and so on. If you're a mathematician, you can keep on putting kinks there and get wonderful shapes and nice mathematical questions like each kink makes it longer, but makes the line longer by less, and the mathematicians have fun with things like that. But in the real world, if you do that kind of thing, you run into trouble. And the Greek atomists realized that. Think of water. Take an ocean, divide it into bays, divide the bays into coves, which have the same shape as the bays, incidentally, like these fractals. As you look more closely at a fractal, you can't tell what scale you're looking at. You can divide the bays into buckets, and you can take a cup of water and divide it an octillion times, but then you have to stop. You come down to a molecule. You can divide it. It's quite easy to break up a molecule of water, but you don't have water. And that's what happens with plots at a certain time. You can go on subdividing your plot up to the point where the thing that you have isn't a plot. So what is a plot? To work on this, you can look at people in almost all areas. They will say that a plot, whether it's the plot of a small element in a work of literature or a 1,000-page novel basically has three parts. A part which, as the anthropologists tend to say in their writings, something's gone wrong. Then a second step, something is needed, and then a third step, something gets done. The princess is in a tower. She wants out. The prince liberates her. That can be the plot of a 1,000-page epic, or it can be the plot of two or three lines of some other work of literature. In any case, the minimal unit of plot has to to have those three elements. And I won't quote lots of people who say this, but you find them in the French school, the American school, the Russian school. An awful lot of the best people agree on this. Grémas in Paris expressed it maybe most elegantly. The first step in a plot can be expressed with the verb to be and an adjective. The princess is in a tower. In a tower being adjectival. Second, with a modal verb. Would, wants, needs, something of that sort. And the third part with an active verb. So it can be defined linguistically. Aristotle, being Aristotle, said that the unit of plot has to have big or little, he used it both, mentions it both in different places. It has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. The beginning is something that doesn't need anything before it. The end is something that doesn't need anything after it. And you can guess what the middle is. It's something that needs both. We have a something that everybody, including Aristotle, seems to agree on. And when you have that, you've got to be wrong. What's the problem with this? I'd like to think. I'd like to think for a minute of the. I have to use jargon now briefly. There are two terms that I wrote on your handout: the fabula and the sujet. Those are both Russian words, one of them originating in the Latin, the other originating in the French. They can both be translated by the word plot. They are, in both cases, the arrangement of the incidents. But the fabula is the arrangement of the incidents in the world where the characters live. And the sujet is the arrangement of the incidents in the world where the, in the world of the text. And that means that the fabula is multidimensional. The characters live in a world that's a mimesis, a copy of our world. Virtually all of us live in three dimensions plus time. But the sujet is one-dimensional. And that enables us to rephrase Lessing's Laocoon problem and say the problem of an author is to squeeze a multidimensional fabula into a one-dimensional sujet. This presents a lot of complications to the author. It also presents an enormous number of opportunities, because it's in the collision between the fabula and the sujet that many, many of the literary devices that people talk about really exist. Dramatic irony, wonderful term. The situation where a character in the play operating in the fabula doesn't know something that the sujet has already revealed to the reader, so that the reader is one up on the character. This feeling of sometimes of superiority, sometimes of horror, all sorts of different feelings grow out of this tension between the fabula and the sujet. But the tension can operate the opposite direction. In a detective story, at least one of the characters in the old-fashioned detective story, at least one of the characters in the fabula knows who done it, and the reader is racking his or her brain to try and figure out who done it. So the tension between the fabula and the sujet grows out of this Laocoon problem, as I've restated it. The whole question of two of the other great literary devices, suspense, and it's the other version of suspense, which the French call curiosité, are again a part of that pattern. Suspense, you have the reader struggling to figure out what's going to happen. In this curiosité, you have the reader struggling to figure out what's happening right now in the text. Those are two very different literary techniques, but they both arise out of this tension between the fabula and the sujet. Now, my correction for Aristotle and most of the other best literary theorists is that the tripartite division into beginning, middle, and end works beautifully for the fabula. It really describes what's going on. But in the sujet, an incident has a different shape. In the sujet, an incident has the shape of an expectation and one of two things, its fulfillment or its frustration. And that the author, that is what an incident really is and the way an incident works in the sujet. This has an interesting implication. That is, the fabula really follows the old pattern and fills the old requirement that a work of literature represent something or imitate something. The sujet is not representational. It's manipulative. What happens in the sujet is that the author is working directly on us and shifting our position, juggling our position, working for and against our reactions to a text. So that it's in the sujet that the author can insert a digression, have something that simply tell us another story, or do introduce a bit of philosophy, having nothing to do with the fabula, because the sujet has this other structure. Sometimes the interruption or digression is just to increase suspense, but it can have many other purposes, a couple of which I'll talk about in a moment. So this is now I think we know what an incident is. It can be big or small, it's fractal. In the fabula, it is tripartite. In the sujet, basically bipartite. And in the sujet, it is used manipulatively. In the fabula, it is used mimetically, representing something. We're halfway there. Our next problem is to we know something about what an incident is. How are incidents related? On this, I have a challenge for you all. I think there's only four or five ways they can be related. If you could find more, I'd love it. The order is immaterial. They can be arranged chronologically. And spatially, and some people combine those two, some don't. That's why it's four or five. They can be arranged narratively. They can be arranged by association. Those are the main ways that I'll be talking about. Let's talk about the narrative way first, because I'm not going to deal with it much. Narratively, one incident can be related to another by embedding it one incident is told by somebody in another incident. It's the shape, say, of the Decameron, where a group of people sit around in bad and then good circumstances and tell stories. Or the most extraordinary example of that process of embedment is the Arabian Nights, where Scheherazade's survival depends on her ending a story in such a way that the caliph demands needs another story. So that one incident is each story that she tells is part of another story. But then within her stories, you have characters who tell stories. for similar reasons or other reasons. And within those stories, there are sometimes characters that tell stories. Down for five levels, this is the most sophisticated game of narrative embedding that's been tried yet, that I know of. That's a wonderful corner of plot studies that I'm not going to be going into for now. Let's think for a minute, though, about the chronological relations. In the sujet, that's easy. One event, one incident has to precede or follow another. Oh, you can play games, you can interrupt, and you can repeat and do things like that. But the basic structure of the sujet makes the chronological relationship of events very simple. Fabula is much more fun. For one thing, you can have simultaneous events. And when you say in the fabula, meanwhile back in the ranch, you are saying something about the... you're bringing in space. You're adding that extra dimension to make so that the chronological and the spatial in the fabula have to work together. And when they do work together, very often they have social, moral, and philosophical overtones. Upstairs, downstairs is describing two social worlds. Dante's Inferno is an up-down story, or a down-up-down, a down-up story. And you have something similar. So that here, time and space have expanded meanings. Bakhtin in Russia worked on this connection with time and space. So you can do really extraordinary things by relating elements, relating incidents in time and in space. If you move on and try to, and there's a lot more there, in history, every event has to occur at a given time and a given space, a given place. That information may be lost, but a historian has to assume that that happened. In literature, you can have pure acrimony. That is no time at all. You can have a list of events, a bill of particulars, or something, an argument, people citing incidents, and no time mentioned. No time exists then. Literature is much purer than history for our purposes. So there's lots to be done with that relationship. But then you have the causal one. And one event can be related to another one in time, but it can also be related causally. And if one event causes another, then you have a what may be described sometimes as a tree. That is, each event has a cause, several causes and several effects. Each of which has several causes and several effects. Each of which has several causes and several effects. And very soon you get into something which completely defies the Laocoon problem. How do you squeeze that into a straight line? Can't be done. And normally you simplify it in literature to a train of events. Event A causes event B, causes event C, causes event D, and so on. Now, time and space are related to causality most of the time, but not always simply because of psychological causation. When one event in the future causes something, we call it a goal or a motive. When something in the past causes something, we call it an incitement or something of that sort. So introducing the human psyche into the picture adds this additional element to the causal system. Now, the other way that events can be linked is through analogy or association. One event can be like another event. And that's enormously important. I'm going to be spending a good deal of my time next week talking about the dramatic use of that connection. So I have now defined a plot and tried to give you a sense of how a plot works. Next time, we'll try and take these abstractions and bring them to bear on King Lear. And that's where I'll probably fall flat on my face.